Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Ryan Fraser.
This is Troy Daly.
This is Gus Boyett.
This is Don Hutchison.
This is Jurgen Klopp, and you're listening to The Big Interview with Graham Hunter.
Thank you, Jurgen. I travel to all these interviews from Barcelona, and our socios, our beloved members, keep us on the road. This independent podcast wouldn't happen without them. Please go to patreon.com/Graham Hunter right now to join us, to become a socio, and to get every interview we produce without adverts and before it goes out on the main feed, plus lots of bonus content, including the chance to put questions to our guests and to me via the monthly Q&A. You will also get bonus content every month, including the audio versions of my regular columns for ESPN. So do please go to patreon.com/Graham Hunter and join the club and get your family and friends to do so. Maybe even strangers in the street. Love you. Welcome back to The Big Interview. It's a delight to have you. Hi, it's Graham. My guest today is Stuart Baxter, one of my favourite storytellers in football. I first got to know him after his team AIK Solna in Stockholm won the Swedish Championship, and the antics of their hardline ultra Black Army fans got so out of hand, including one of them arriving in Stuart's office with a gun to demand better results, that when I interviewed him and wrote it up in the newspaper I was working for at the time, it kind of went a bit viral in the pre-viral days, to the extent that I ended up talking about it on BBC Radio 5 mid-morning with Nicky Campbell, because people just couldn't believe that AIK Solna's fans were as mental as indeed they were. Stuart was a guy to stay in touch with, and indeed by 2003, when the South African FA were looking for a coach to replace John Mosono, they phoned Benny McCarthy's agent, Rob Moore. Rob phoned me, and I put forward the names of Gianluca Vialli, Walter Smith, Stuart Baxter, people I could vouch for and who I thought would do a good job. They went for Baxter partly because he was able to quote as references three people who stood out in football: Arsene Wenger, Sir Bobby Robson, and Sven-Göran Eriksson. So those were three friends and contacts of Stuart who spoke up for him, and he became South Africa manager. Stuart's also the guy responsible for the cracking story about when at Vissel Kobe, he and his family decided to stay on after the devastating earthquake there ripped the city apart. The owner of Vissel Kobe was so grateful for this, and boy, that owner features in this interview, and it's fascinating, that he said, yeah, you can sign anybody you want. Stuart said, look out, it'll be Michael Laudrup. Anyway, the long and short is, when Laudrup was about to leave to go to join Stuart in Japan, the King of Spain approached him in a restaurant in Spain's capital. And look, the story gets told in this interview. It's an interview whereby the colour, the intensity, the eccentricities, idiosyncrasies of football just scream out. And we think also that if some of you don't know Stuart's name, we still think this show works best when we speak not only to current stars like Virgil van Dijk and Emiliano Martinez, or bona fide long-term legends like Luca Vialli or Chris Waddle. But it also works best when some of football's great storytellers, they're pioneers, and this is a man who's travelled to work in, as I said, Sweden, South Africa, Portugal, Finland. Stuart belongs in both of these categories. To me, he's also a legend. Look, he's won championships. He's worked with some of the biggest names in the game over a career that spanned four decades. Born in Wolverhampton, his accent might sound English to you, Midlands, but he's a Scot, I promise you. So, listen in. You're going to enjoy this. Here's part one of my chat with Stuart Baxter. I hope you've brought your passport with you. We're going all around the world. Sometimes in the long and, in my own words, distinguished history of the Big Interview, something that started out as a wee jolly jape, but has become, some might say, Pulitzer Prize worthy. Sometimes there's an interview which is just pure pleasure. And it's this one. We're in the presence of the mighty Stuart Baxter, a man who has influenced football all across the globe, been highly successful, but a man with whom, for one reason or another, my career is inextricably intertwined. Stuart, that's not the kind of fancy language I normally use when we're chatting, so I'll just get down to brass tacks and say, welcome, thank you for joining the Big Interview. For those who are only listening in audio, there are some pretty damn impressive pennants and jerseys around you in your office. Where are you and what am I looking at?
I'm in Sweden, Graham. Nice to be here. Much more nicer to be talking to you. I've got my very first South African shirt behind me there. I've got Cristiano Ronaldo's shirt when we played Portugal and he scored a penalty with Finland and he beat us 1-0. And my first England shirt is down there. I think that's Nicky Butt's shirt that we played against Australia. So that's what's around me in here.
It's pretty damn impressive compared to the bare walls you can see behind me. But Stuart, before I start asking you questions, let's play true-false. Mr. Stuart Baxter, at some stage, at least once in your professional career, have you been menaced with a loaded gun?
True.
Stuart Baxter, at some stage in your professional life, has your house, and sadly your family, come very close to being enveloped by an earthquake? True or false?
True.
Stuart, was the experience of being in a dressing room with Jim McLean scarier than either of those? True or false?
True.
Stuart, are you one of the best-travelled British managers in the history of the modern game? True or false?
Some would say most travelled. Some would say journeyman.
No, this is who hurt you, Stuart? You're in a safe space here. Most travelled because highly desired and highly successful. Stuart, let's go to Jim McLean, because sadly there'll be some people listening to this who've forgotten that he was probably, including Arsene Wenger, the only manager that has ever really gone nose to nose, toes to toe with Sir Alex Ferguson when the two of them were forming the new firm, Dundee United and Aberdeen. And if not utterly succeeded, one, got right under Fergie's skin, two, not backed off one inch, three, he took Dundee United to a couple of European finals, one European final and a European Cup semi-final where they were roundly cheated by the then people in charge at AS Roma. Explain your experiences of, I don't think he was christened Wee Jim, but he should have been christened Wee Fiery Jim McLean.
I was at Preston. We played Dundee United in a pre-season friendly. Andy Ray was playing his last game for Dundee United before he went to Aston Villa. So I was marking Andy Gray. I had a decent game, difficult to play against Andy at that time. Brave as a lion and made his presence felt. So I thought I did quite well. I did that well that Jim loaned me from Preston. The loan became a transfer, a very short one. And my experience of him was, at that time, quite positive. You know, it was quite, I thought, oh, I like this fella. He's a competitor, he's a winner. But that sort of winning instinct, when we played our first game at Ibrox against Rangers and he stormed in throwing cups around and ripped the door off its hinges and threatened everybody, including the kit man in the dressing room, that was a little bit of an awakening for me. But it didn't get any better. It just got worse. So it was. But as soon as we were away from the match, he was an absolute tough on the training field.
Had you seen ferocity like that in football before?
No, never, never. Maybe I led a sheltered life, Graham, I don't know. I'd seen glimpses of that, you know, but Jim was ferocious. Big lads like Davy Neary, they cringed when he went off on one.
What interests me is that because you've coached in so many countries, most of which we'll we'll come to, but they would include Portugal and Japan and Finland and South Africa and England. It goes on and on and on. I imagine you've had to change your psychology or be adaptable in your psychology, adaptable in your management skills. Do you think there'll ever be a place for, you know, the most ferocious type of Jim McLean, Alex Ferguson experience? Alex Ferguson was widely misunderstood because the easy pigeonholing of Furious Fergie lasted longer than Fergie because he changed. But do you think that's gone forever in football?
Let's backtrack first and find out where did that come from? Well, the first coaching came from the military, didn't it? Listen, son, do as I tell you, or people will get killed. And that was wake yourself up, son. And that was where it came from. And then we drifting through now to a sort of guided discovery. I'll ask you open questions and hope that you suddenly discover what I want you to do. You know, the two ends of the scale. You know, I think the modern coach has got to be able to do all of those things, and he's got to know when to do it. Now, if you get it wrong, then you're probably not a very good coach, but at the right time, if you're going to liven people up, if they've come in and they've not put it in, and the players have not given what you think they should be giving, then why is it not in its place to go back to that military style, get back online, lads, and do as I'm telling you? You know, let's get back to our best. Why is that not in place? Now, I'm not saying that being an instructor sometimes, being an inspirer sometimes, being a father figure sometimes, put your arm around players is, I think that is the modern coach. And society has changed since back then, and kids have changed, football players have changed, their priorities are different, and we just need to know which hat to put on. But does it have a place? Probably still.
Do you think, because you've touched on something that I hold dear, and the more I travelled, the more I felt it to be true, that one of the things that made British football so successful before you or I were born, but during our lives, because we're sort of similar in age group, was the fact that when there wasn't mass communication and when there wasn't mass sharing of information, that military style of coaching, particularly when, you know, there were many times when an international coach in Britain wasn't allowed to pick. It was the team was picked by committee. But well into my working career as a journalist, British footballers were largely expected to do as they were told on the pitch. And if you were all together, you were unified, and it was an 11-man effort, and the coach was clever, it functioned. But as you looked around, particularly as I began to travel, you saw devolved intelligence where players on the pitch could actually take a grasp of a 20-minute period or a 30-minute period, or could rip up the tactics if they weren't working instead of waiting until half-time. And that began to divide the two spheres of football during our working careers.
100% correct. And even though I'd been abroad and I'd worked a lot abroad, the very first time I saw the big difference was when I visited Arsenal I visited Arsene, and he was working. And when I watched him working, I realised that the Arsenal players must be experiencing such a vast difference between... I'm not talking about quality. I'm not talking about Arsene counter George Graham, who was the best. I'm saying there must have been such a huge difference in the delivery of information, and that's what you're getting at there. That it could be a well organised, do as I tell you, son. Very left brain, very logical thinking. Struggling to be a bit creative, aren't we? Yeah. Well, that's not strange, is it? You know. So that one. And then you've got the Arsene sort of guiding people and being tough at the right time, talking transition suddenly, you know, instead of sitting back and being a counter-attacking team, we'll get after people, we'll provoke a transition, then we'll explode away. You know, these must have been two vastly different things. But as you quite rightly say, it was a journey that it's probably still going on today. It's probably still not finished yet.
I think we're at the extreme edge of it, and we're going to come back to that, because I know that although you hold views that are different from the voguish ideas at the moment. Yours are effective, and you're a good thinker in that you don't reject what's happening. You analyse it and you ask people to look closely. But I want to move back a little bit to the first time we talked. And I was an inquisitive young reporter on a desk in Scotland. And I can't remember why I decided to investigate Scots who were abroad. Now I'm calling you a Scot. You might have been born on the wrong side of the border, but you're ours. I claimed you long, long ago. I remember celebrating the fact that Scot had won a foreign league because you won the title in Sweden, and this wasn't your first coaching experience by a long, long way. But you were a title winner in a major European country at a time when, for example, not long different from when Gothenburg were ripping things up and beating Manchester United in the Champions League. And if you asked literally everybody in Britain what was the name of Stuart Baxter's title-winning side in Sweden, I think maybe about six people would be able to name them. Do you know what I mean? So tell us about Solna, and then I'm going to ask you specifically about what it was, the incident at Solna, that got me, once I interviewed you, splashed all over BBC Radio 5.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, the story really starts in Japan, because I just won the championship in Japan, and Arsene Wenger had come to Nagoya. So Arsene was at Grampus. I then moved from San Fretcher, where I won the championship, to Kobe, and we were there one year simultaneously. So Arsene then moved to Arsenal, and I, at the end of my stint there, moved to AIK in Stockholm. So Arsene did the double at Arsenal, I did the double in Sweden, and we got drawn against each other in the Champions League. So that's where that one ties in. Arsene had gone there, I'd gone to Sweden, and I went to a club that was a big club, passionate supporters, and yet had done nothing for 10 years. I had to walk into the club and really own the place, because there were big personalities in the dressing room. Very similar to Arsenal. Arsene walked in with Tony Adams and Bold and Keown and people like that. Big personalities. So I walked in. Johan Mjelby was one of them that the Scots fans would know. So we walked in, and it had to be, this is the way we're going to play. And you're talking about the military. This was very much Stuart Baxter's idea. And guys, I don't want a discussion about this. This is what we're going to do, because this will win us the league. So we started. We started quite poorly. And I'm sure you're going to ask me about that little period a bit later. And then suddenly we went on another 13 games where we didn't concede a goal. And that was in the middle of a Champions League episode as well. So we went in and we ended up winning. We won the championship. Of course, I became quite popular. We stayed another 2 years because it was just like the most electrifying time of my career, probably, because you were playing so close to the edge all the time. I remember we were leading the league my second year. We got booed off the field at half time at 0-0 because we weren't playing well enough. So it was edgier seat stuff.
Tell people, what is Solna? Let's leave AIK aside again. Describe Solna. Describe life in Solna, not just as a football man, you know, because if people are listening to this on their way into work at Worksop, or commuting to Arbroath or Dungannon, and they're like, I wouldn't mind a couple of years in Stockholm. So tell people what Solna is, where it is, what it's like.
Solna, it's basically a little suburb of Stockholm. Stockholm is a magnificently elegant city. Solna is a very ordinary place. Solna is straight up and down. You know, it's just rows of flats, and the National Stadium was in Solna. So, which is where we played our games. And IAK Solna was, and the people used to go mental if you said IAK Stockholm. It was a very old, traditional Swedish club. And so they were very proud people, very passionate. Playing for IAK is like, I don't want to say it's special, but when we played Fiorentina in the Champions League, we had an Australian player. And there was an Australian player playing for Fiorentina. And he came up to him before the game. He says, what's it like playing for these? He says, because all our lads are talking about it. So that's what it was like. The Fiorentina players knew that coming to play in Solna was like going to the Sami Aliene or one of these sort of places in Istanbul. The Black Army is the AIK Solna ultras, if you want to call them that. I don't like calling them that. They don't like being called that. They're the Black Army. They're on one specific, the north side of the stadium. And they were the ones that booed us off at half-time, basically. After each game, the players would go and stand there in front of them and either take their wrath, or they would be doing the wave with them, and people would be jumping out of the crowd, and they would be, yeah, exactly, we'd be thanking them. I've played a game against Barty Borisov in the Champions League, where we opened the first 5-10 minutes quite slowly, which they didn't like. We were leading 2-0, we beat them away, so I don't know if it was like, how do we approach this game, really? They then went on a sort of a chant that was like, basically it was, come on, Aiko, come on, Aiko, come on, for 30 minutes, non-stop. They stopped just before half-time. I'm not joking, it was the bench. We kept looking at the supporters. It was like, I can't believe this. And the players went from being a bit slow to absolutely flying at people. We were 1-0 up at half-time when we ended up beating them 2-0 again. So they could literally lift the team up. And they can now. They're the same now. The generations just keep coming, and it's amazing.
I'm here to tell you about another podcast. Yes, we believe in biodiversity. It's from the makers of The Big Interview, and it's called Between the Lines, the stories behind great sports writing. Every episode takes a classic sports book or outstanding piece of sports writing and examines how the writer crafted their story. This is a weekly show, and the series so far has featured documentaries on The Miracle of Castel di Sangro and Andrea Pirlo's autobiography, I Think, Therefore I Play. There's also interviews with writers like Henry Winter, Simon Cooper, Andy Mitten, and David Goldblatt. Now, a friend of mine, Lawrence Donegan, on his classic golf book, Four Iron in the Soul.
You know, you just write a book, and it's just some sort of alchemy that you don't understand what's happening.
That's a good word.
And lo and behold, at the end of it, it's like something's... It comes together and something's happened that you're not even aware it was happening at the time. I think Nick Hornby talked about this, about Fever Pitch. You just wrote a book, not that Fever that's anywhere near as good as Fever Pitch, but, you know, there's just some sort of alchemy, mysterious thing that happens in the process of writing a book, and the book is greater than, for some reason, it's actually better and bigger and more appealing than you actually intended. And lo and behold, as you say, 20 years later we're still talking about it, and people still talk about it, people absolutely love it in a way. And those kind of books that hit some kind of chord that you know, some kind of bullseye that you weren't aiming for, but somehow it hit that bullseye, and that's why they'll last.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Do you know, I know that psychology and philosophy has entered a lot into your managerial career, and we'll come to why. When you first explained the Black Army to me, I thought that it was a bit, it was such an odd piece of human interaction, because you came to them and delivered them success after a barren time, and you and they were nose to nose, toe to toe a lot of the time. You wouldn't call it total harmony. And how can it be that you bring them success, you're on the edge all the time, and yet it's a bit cat and dog the whole time you're there?
The beginning was the worst. The beginning was the worst. I came from Japan. We had a fantastic pre-season. I think we won a tournament down in Marbella where we beat, I think it was the top Norwegian teams, the FC Copenhagen and Brøndby, and the top Danish teams. And they were really thinking, this is our year, you know. And then we opened like 0-0, 1-1, 0-1. And it, after about six games, I remember we played a game at home, drew, and the police came to me after the game and said that, Stuart, there's some of the lads want to speak to you. I said, what? I said, no, just, I think you better come out and just speak to them. I went out and there was four lads, and one was very well dressed, and another one was, got a big leather jacket on, and I says, yeah. And the one jumped in my face and he's going, this is not good enough for us. And then another one just put his arm across his chest and said, hey, calm down. He says, listen, Stuart. And I said, and then I jumped in, didn't I, like big mouth. I went, hey, if you want to go down in the dressing room, you'll see other people that are sick. You'll see other people that care. So don't come to me and give. And of course, then this lad went, yeah, okay, Stuart, have a beer with us. They'd fronted me basically to test me out, you know, has this guy got any bottle? So they just walked away. The policeman said, as we're walking down the stairs, be careful, Stuart. He says, the one with the leather jacket, he smashed someone's kneecap with a baseball bat because he owed him 200 crowns, which is about 20 quid. Okay. And, you know, the amount of times I said me and my big mouth that evening was incredible, you know. So that was my beginning with them. Then we went on this run. And in the middle of all this, my wife's mother, God bless her, she had cancer. And so I had to take 1 week away from it in the summer, where I went down, I stayed with my wife and her mother when she was passing away. And I went back. And there was a massive flat banderole spread across, "We are Baxter's bodyguards." They were incredible. I loved them. I loved them. And from there, and it was like this, resign, you bastard. If we lost 1-0, it was resign. Get them, you know. And it was pretty hectic. I mean, one in the bad times, one of them placed a letter bomb in the offices of the club, and the police came and we had to get out of the. I mean, that was the bad. They are not like that now. I have to add, they are not like they are. I believe they're the best supporters I've ever seen. But they have you on the edge all the time.
I suppose that whether you consider yourself Scottish or English, one of the things that unites you and I is a certain degree of ferocity and not just big mouth, but a certain, you stick your chest out and you go head first into life. I suppose those sort of things, they don't make you do more work or better work, but when you are exposed to outside edges of human passion, it impacts on you. And I think you notice it. It's not just a 9-to-5 job for you. I believe, listening to you over the years, that sort of thing, you don't want your family to be under threat. You don't want letter bombs. But you've got a capacity to go, I understand what these people are like and what they want, and I'll do it my way, but I don't mind a little bit of storm and drying going on around me.
If you talk about enlightenment, you talk about a journey where you find out about yourself. So if I'm more enlightened now than I was when I started my football journey, it's not surprising, because I've found out about myself. In certain situations, you've got to keep it together. And in certain situations, it's like, you see, you don't do a better job, but you make sure you do a good job. Whereas if you're not as adjusted as I was, then maybe you bottle it and maybe you do a crap job and you get the sack. Well, I didn't. You know, I mean, I didn't. I went on and I won the championship. I could have very easily panicked, not stood up for myself, not stood up for the team. You know, I remember the game we played against Gothenburg when we went on this run. It was away. We had a man sent off and we had 10 men. And we battled, and then we scored a set play with 5 minutes to go. And I remember what I said to the players before the game, you know, and they all looked at me. It was that look where it's don't worry about us, mate, you know. And I said to them, I says, now, look, I says, you know what's going on? You know the stuff that's been happening? Now, we've got two choices. I said, we either bottle it and you change, or it's no compromise. And we win things our way. Now, it's no compromise or it's compromise. What are we going to do? No compromise, Gaffer. We went out, they ran their legs off, and it was 1-0. And we went on a run then of a run that won the championship. So it was, I remember the day. I can remember the moment as clear as it was yesterday.
A lot of these things, in my opinion, particularly derived from the interviews we've done in this series, are innate, they're born into you, but we all change. I think we can all get softer or harder or wiser. And I want to ask you, if I don't remember wrongly, in one of our long chats, I think that it was probably as a schoolboy where, for one reason or another, I don't know if it was to do with your Scottish roots or whatever, life had been a little bit bumpy with maybe older kids or other kids. And I was speaking recently, I don't know if you know this, to big Robert Huth, who was at Chelsea and Leicester, won a title at Leicester, Jeremy. And growing up in Berlin, you'd never judge it now because you wouldn't look badly at big Robert. He did a tough time and took to judo. And if I don't remember wrongly, at minimum, there was an element of karate, which it's what separates us. I'm a karaoke man, which means full hand. And you're a karate man, which means open hand, which means we're united by KAR. It changes you because it isn't just either the kata side or the combative side. It's a lot about philosophy and ideology. And that did, as a young man, that made a difference to you, right?
It wasn't the reason that I started doing martial arts. But I think in later years, I look back And I think that may have been an underlying stimulus. When my father was the coach at Aston Villa and I would be going to school, you know, the older boys would be, oh, the coach at Villa's crap and they're useless. And then it would be turning around and smack and we'd be kicking off and I'd always get a walloping because I wasn't, you know, they were 5 and 6 years older than me, but I wasn't having people say that about my dad. And so that was the sort of a background. And then I started to, I met an English guy who, in Sweden, who had, he'd represented England in an Olympic Games when they'd won a gold medal. And he was a sensei, he was a teacher. So I started working with him and it became more and more and more. And then when I went to Japan, I was really into it and I was trying to sort of then pick up the more, let's say, philosophical or spiritual side of martial arts. So it developed more into that. It developed more into a way of living or a way of thinking or just putting it into your training, your everyday training. So, yeah, and it did. It did. It affected my thinking about sports. I mentioned that the word enlightenment, where did I get that from? It's from martial arts. You know, the way to enlightenment through the empty hand. Karate Do, you know, that's what it is. And I often say to young kids, you know, you can get that enlightenment through football. Dedicate yourself to football, find out about yourself in defeat, find out about yourself in success, dedicate yourself to being the best you can be. You can get that in almost any sport, but especially football.
When you began as a young man at martial arts, what did it begin to teach you that was beyond the physical? What were the philosophical things that will later come in useful to you when you tried to? Because Wenger, and for listeners, they need to understand that we're talking to a man when you and I were first chatting about the possibility of job applications. You said, "Oh yeah. My references will be Sven Gornex and Bobby Robson and Arsene Wenger." Okay, that'll do for me. Yeah. What did karate teach you philosophically?
Well, when I did kickboxing, it teaches me I wasn't very good. But I mean, apart from getting kicked all over the place, no, it teaches you things like dedication. It teaches you to concentrate on the here and now. It teaches you to not get carried away with successes. It teaches you control. That's probably the word I'm looking for, is control. So I don't know how much did that play a part of when you're facing that first 8 games at Ayako and it's not going well, and you need to stay focused, stay determined, do a good job, don't just fade away. How much control did I gain there? Maybe, you know, but I think that's definitely one of the aspects of it that's helped me.
When you go to Japan, and you know, it's a terrific, you know already that for a couple of reasons, I'm going to focus more on Kobe. But as you said, you won a title. Why do you end up in Japan? What was winning that first title like? And how has the Japanese experience shaped you? Because it's possibly for a Western British-born man or woman, I think it's one of the most radical culture changes you can be introduced to.
I tried to get as good a handle on it as I could. And then I was helped because when I went into the club at Sanfrecce in Hiroshima, not one of the big mega-rich clubs, so we had to look. We couldn't sign Leonardo and Buchwald and people like that the others could. I was looking in the Czech Republic and I was looking across the water in Korea. So, you know, I picked up players there, but then they weren't big-time Charlies. They were team players. So I was careful to make sure that we had the structure was correct and the instructional part was important for them. And we surprised everybody. We won the league. We both have the utmost respect for the Japanese people. I mean, I think, you know, we saw them recovering from the Kobe earthquake. We were there. We were with them. And I saw the unbelievable bravery. I saw the unbelievable determination. And they made us feel like one of them. They really did.
How did you manage as competitors and in a country whereby probably your time was massively devoted to coping with a new culture? How did you manage to make decent friends with Arsene Wenger?
I met Arsene at a coaching course in Copenhagen. It would be about 28 years ago. I'm still talking to a friend of mine, a physical coach called Roger Spry, and we're talking about Jens Bangsbo. Jens Bangsbo was a Dane who was working for Juventus, and he was put on this demonstration of plyometrics. And we were standing, and Roger, who was a fitness coach, he was saying to me, "Oh, this is interesting, isn't it?" And then suddenly a head came in between us and said, "Yes, I think this is very interesting." And it was Arsene. And then, of course, then he started talking, and he said, "I'm Arsene Wenger, and this and this." And we were on talking for about 30 minutes, and he finished up by inviting me to go to Monaco with a couple of my younger players from Halmstad, and that he would do the same. You know, he would bring a couple of his kids across, and we started like that. So I went to Monaco. Wind forward, my next job after Halmstad was in Japan, and Arsene then resigned. He resigned from Monaco, and then he was 6 months out of work, and then Nagoya said to me, "We have a friend. We were playing them. We have a friend of yours in the stadium." "Oh, really?" I says, "Yeah." He says, "Yes, he would like to see you after the game." So after the game, I think we lost 1-0. And I'm wandering through all these little corridors, and then I open the door. Wenger's sitting there, isn't he? And he says, "Hello, Stuart." And I went, "Oh, thanks for letting me know you're coming," sort of thing, you know. So I met him after the game. And we and then after that, he was there for the time he was. He went to Arsenal and I went to AIK. But we got on really well, and I didn't speak French, but I spoke the same language, I think.
Because he's talked at length about the fact that, in his own words, I'm not being mean to him, he says he's a terrible loser, a desperate loser. And he explained that the Japanese culture taught him to try and cope with defeat in a different way.
He loves Japan. Arsene loves Japan. I could, when people were asking me, Will Arsene leave Arsenal? I would answer them, if Arsene leaves Arsenal, I think he will go to Japan. You know, and sometimes our conversations would be like, will your next job be Bayern Munich? Or, you know, and he would ask me, you know, would you go back to Japan? And I got the feeling that Arsene was capable of saying, top flight football, forget about it. I'll go back to Japan. I'll take a small team. I'll even take young kids. I'll open an academy, you know, and take kids that had no parents from the Fukushima or from the Kobe earthquake. And I had the feeling that Arsene could very, very much do that, because I think he was so impressed with Japan and valued his time there so much.
You talked then about Kobe a couple of times, and again, it was after that you and I first spoke. But subsequently, when we went back over it, you explained to me just the most extraordinary things. I think you'd been away scouting, maybe even signing a footballer in Portugal with maybe the club secretary. And I hadn't known that the Kobe natural disaster had actually started offshore. So I'm sorry to ask for a retelling of a traumatic event, but it is, in human terms, when you travel the world, when you experiment, things can happen that are absolutely extraordinary. What then am I hinting at? The fact that you get woken up at Portugal, in Portugal, by a banging on the door to be told what's happening, right? And back home, your wife and kids are seeing the disaster coming towards them.
The epicenter was a couple of kilometres from where we lived. But the epicenter ran in a westerly direction. So passed in front of us instead of going towards us in a northerly direction. And therefore, we were relatively... And we were on a bit of a mountain, so as it dissipated, as it reached us, but still walls falling down and stuff like that, and still massively traumatic. But I got woken up, and I looked at CNN, and it was in Portuguese. So all I could see was the earthquake, and I could see Japanese writing. And I said, oh, yeah, is it Tokyo? They said, no, it's Kobe. And I've got the president, I think it was the CEO, in the next room with his family in Kobe and my family in Kobe. And we had to try and get back. And of course, that was chaos, trying to get back in. So when we got back in, it was the aftershocks, and it was the city in ruins. And it was very, 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 very difficult. I mean, they said to me, you can go, take your family and go. We'll give you 1 year's money. This is not your fight. And I stayed, obviously, because I'd taken it on. They were going to pay all of the foreigners that I'd taken four of a staff, and I'd signed players, and they were going to give everybody 1 year's money and thank you, and it's not your fight. And then a new president came in who had, God bless him, Takasago-san, and he said to me, Baxter-san, Give us a team that will show this city that you can't be beaten. He said, if you can do that, I'll back you. So, like, football just went out the window, and it was now, this was something much, much bigger. And in the first, our training pitch had a split down the side. It was like a wave had passed through it. The showers were all down. So we got demoted into the second league and had to win that league to prove that we could host the J-League. Well, the first 12 games, it was disastrous. It was disastrous. We couldn't train. Everybody was depressed. It was like the aftershocks were going off all the time. I think we won two games in 12. And then at the turnaround, Takasago-san came and said, I'm moving you to a training field that I've built for you. And we had a home suddenly. And the players just... And I think we won 13 on the spin. It was unbelievable. It was like you just plugged them in. It was like, whap! And at the end of the season, we missed promotion by, I think, a point. And the following year, we got promotion. And he said to me, and he didn't speak very good English. And he was drinking, and he looked a little bit tipsy. And then he suddenly looked at my wife, and he said, I will look after your family as long as I've got blood in my body. And he went, and you can buy any player you want. Ha ha ha. I said, don't say that. I said, I might sign Michael Laudrup from Real Madrid. And in the morning, his secretary came to the house with a letter for me saying, I've booked our flights to Madrid. You speak to Michael. And we went to Madrid and we signed Michael Laudrup. So that was his gift to the city.
Thank you for listening to The Big Interview. It's produced by me, which sounds egotistical, but it's also true. Graham Hunter. And Backpage. Our music is by Beer Jacket, who else? Editing by Charlie McGarry. Thank you to our hosts at Acast and our loyal sponsors at Bet365. We're also supported by our socios. Find out how to become a socio, how to support us, at patreon.com/Graham Hunter. Here endeth the lesson.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.